Let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
Kevin.
And I'm John.
And this is 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger, the podcast where we take a long, hard look back at some of our favorite action movies from the era of Arnold.
Schwarzenegger is the icon of the genre, but we're taking a deep dive into some of these 80s and 90s cult action movies and breaking them all the way down.
Hi, friends.
Hey.
Hello, friends.
Hey, buns or amigos. That's not the right thing. I don't know.
Greetings to all. Greetings to our friends in Australia, our loyal listeners out there.
G'day.
We love you guys.
Yeah,
we hope you like this movie as much as we do and don't find it like tedious.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, we hope you're not tired of it.
Because it's great and it makes all of us, it endears Australia to all of us in a good way.
The same way that it endears China to us, if you like Bloodsport. I don't know.
Sure.
As anything.
It endears rafting, if you like Deliverance.
Yes. No, that's
so
awesome.
We're here to talk a little bit more about Crocodile Dundee, favorite of both of ours.
This is the last time we're going to talk about
it. Final countdown. And greetings to all listening on the Last of the Action Heroes podcast network. If you enjoy the 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger shtick, check out our own 6 Degrees feed. We've got some old stuff there that is not on the podcast network that you might like. We're working on getting it on the podcast network sooner or later.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you're listening to us on our own feed, thank you, thank you. And check out the podcast network because there's all types of cool shit happening over there for people who grew up watching these awesome 80s and 90s like shoot 'em ups.
Yes. We must talk about them to preserve history.
Yes. So I will catch us
no
up.
No one will remember Crocodile Dundee if we don't.
Never. It's dead to me.
Oh, no.
No. Crocodile Dundee, fucking awesome movie.
It's been a joy to revisit this
guy. It's got the simplest of plots. It tells a simple story. It's been told before.
It has, yeah. Exactly.
Fish out of water type shit. But no, we've got Sue Charlton, New York journalist. She's gone to Australia to do a story about this sort of urban legend type tall tale shit about this man, Crocodile Dundee, who miraculously survived a crocodile attack. She goes there. She meets him. She's charmed by him. She invites him to return to New York with her to put a nice bow on the story that she's doing about him. Like, what is it like?
To make her boyfriend jealous. I mean.
She is. She's got a pretty serious boyfriend in New York named Richard, who's also her editor.
Boss. Yeah.
Yeah, it's complicated, to say the least, right? So she brings Dundee to New York, shows him around. He makes friends right away, but he's also like not used to all the hustle and bustle of the big city. Saves her life at least once.
Makes a big impression with the New York socialite crowd.
Yeah, he like fits in a dive bar in the East Village. He fits in an art scene party like on the Upper East Side or whatever. Making all types of friends. The big issue is Sue has fallen in love with him, apparently.
While she's still with Richard, who she's, quote, in love with.
So when we last saw them, he saved her from a mugger.
In the iconic, that's not a knife, that's a knife scene.
True. They had a big passionate kiss. Sue's life has gotten a lot more complicated. That's where we're at.
Well, if you remember Crocodile Dundee like we do, and we do, then you're excited about this last bit. So that last scene was the scene that, as we were talking about in the last episode, that you've quoted with all your friends when you were 7 and all your, yeah. your drunk uncles at Thanksgiving. So the morning after that incident, Sue's and Mick's passionate kiss, we're talking about in the subway station. Sue's in her office looking very distracted.
We know what's on her mind.
She's got an ache down under, if you will.
Oh, that device, whatever it was she was working on, was ridiculous.
Giant. What the fuck is that? Like, wowza.
I feel like it's whatever predated the computer.
Right.
Like, it must have been
just a word processor. That's what you called it.
Maybe they were linked up where like an editor or somewhere else, a copy editor could see what she had done. Like,
I think that's
an edit.
You were saving files in like fucking DOS format. Like, and
that shit was nuts. Yeah, it was like huge
on the big floppy disk. So Richard walks into her office. Richard is her boyfriend, who we talked about previously. He walks into her office to show her the stories the paper ran while she was away in Australia, which I get. Yeah, she hasn't seen. She apologizes for hardly realizing that he's there or what he's talking about. Then he tells her that while she was away, he'd been thinking about making some concrete plans for the future. An older man suddenly enters the office and asks, "Are you building a freeway or proposing?" This is Sue's dad, who was kind of jokingly busting her balls for globetrotting on the paper's dime.
A lot has come into focus now, though.
Yeah. Like, oh, she's exorbitantly wealthy.
Yeah, that explains why she's able to be out globetrotting, doing stories that really have fuck all to do with New York.
Right.
Especially because she works for Newsday, which is like a smaller circulation type paper.
She's a New York socialite who's been crotch groped by the allure of slumming it with Crocodile Dundee.
It also may explain her swanky fucking office. Like in the newsroom, she's got her own space, not in the pit with everyone else. Like, she's got a big ass office. I don't know if she's supposed to be the star reporter or just the boss's
daughter. She's the boss's daughter. She can't be that good.
And I saw like one the second boss's boy girlfriend.
Right.
It's kind of like
she is nothing special.
I feel like she's probably hated amongst others working for the Newsday.
No one else at that paper likes her for definite sure. Yeah. So dad says there's a dinner gathering at quote, the weekend house on Sunday.
Yeah, they got that next level money.
He tells her, "You're coming," and to bring Crocodile Dundee along so that I can meet him. So we cut to Sunday evening. Sue, Richard, and Mick are rolling up to a gigantic mansion in the limo.
Where that house was pimping?
Got some facts about that house.
Out on Long Island, Connecticut?
I'll tell you. So The Charlton family's weekend house is a fucking palace. Mick says,
it's like chateau style.
Yeah, it's giant. So Mick says, "I thought your dad sold newspapers." Richard interrupts Sue while she's trying to explain. He's like, "He sells a lot of newspapers."
Yeah, that's okay. A good line.
Yeah. Gus, the driver, who we've seen in previous scenes, like opens
so
the door.
So glad to see Gus again. Yeah. Reginald Vell Johnson.
It always makes me comforted in these uncomfortable scenes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Gus's presence.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, thank God Gus is here. So all of a sudden,
Gus, he's the dad's like personal chauffeur. He's the family chauffeur.
He's the family or business chauffeur. Okay. He works for the family. So we hear dogs barking in the distance as they're getting out of the car. And Sue's immediately like, she gets tense and she's like, oh, hell, the dogs are out. Richard is like scampering, like trying to hurry Sue inside. Gus is hiding behind the limo door. Mick, however, is smiling and like, turns to the pair of these dogs, these Rottweilers, as they're running up, and he busts out the old mind over matter Bushman's trick from the opening act and mesmerizes them. The dogs calm down.
He was supremely confident that
that
works on all animals.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as they're not people, but like he calms the dogs down. He reaches down. He doesn't. I don't know if you saw that. He didn't pet them. He reaches down and lets them smell
his
hand.
Yeah.
And he smiles. And I was like, that's a fucking expert move. You don't touch them. You just let them smell you.
Yeah.
Sue is lathered. Anyway, Mick walks towards the house. Gus smiles at the dogs, who then growl at him, and he's like, never mind, fuck this, and walks like back around the long way around the car.
Reginald Vell Johnson is just a brilliant actor.
He is. His facial expression.
His comic timing, all that type shit.
He's so good. So inside the house, which looks like a museum and for good reason,
okay.
Nick meets the butler, Simpson, with the handshake that he picked up from the dude in the bar. So
yeah,
it's at this point that I did some research. The house was the weekend home in reality. The house was the weekend home of mining tycoon and financier W.B. Thompson. It's in Yonkers, Westchester County.
Where is Yonkers? Is that on
north of the Bronx? So it's north. It's
like mainland New York.
2 miles north of the island of Manhattan. So it's like the Bronx, it's like northwest of Bronx.
Okay.
And it's considered an inner suburb of New York City. According to the Wikipedias, W.B. Thompson lived in the house until his death in 1930. This is amazing. He left $20 million of then money, which is $310 million in modern dollars, in a trust to his wife and daughter just so they'd keep living in the house. I'll leave you $310 million if you stay in the house.
As opposed to what? Selling the house and moving out.
Like, he put so much heart and soul into the house. I just want to know someone's living in the house. They lived in it 20 more years till they sold it to the Archdiocese of New York.
So now it's owned by the church?
I think it was. Now I think it's owned by a private group that like is trying to upkeep the house, like keep it
it's
up.
Like and they do tours and that type shit?
They do events and tours and stuff.
Man,
yeah.
Awesome.
So at one time it was a school. It belonged to, I think, Ithaca College at one point.
Okay.
I own a college.
I tried to research that and I got nowhere. So yeah. Awesome work.
Thanks, brother. Yeah, I thought it was super interesting, especially with the fact that he was like, I'll pay you $300 million to live in the house after I'm dead.
That's amazing.
Like, and they're like, okay.
Yeah.
And so anyway, back to the movie. Simpson the butler says, everyone's waiting for you in the lounge. And then it turns out this is a big dinner party.
Yeah.
I got a question for
you.
Yeah, man, hit me.
I don't know if this would fit with Dundee's character.
Sure.
But I found myself thinking, like, they could have done a thing where either Sue had tried to, you know, like, put Dundee in a tux. You know, like,
I thought about that too.
Put on a tux, you know, come try to fit into my world. Or if it was his idea, like, let me try to be the guy that I think that you want. You know, like, I'm going to try to pretty woman myself or whatever.
And that's very, very interesting.
It would have been an interesting thing. I don't know if it fits with the character of Dundee, who seems so confident in who he is that he doesn't change for anybody.
Yeah, like,
but I wonder, it would have been supremely, I think, intriguing.
Here's a question. If you knew you were taking someone to a formal dinner party like this, which is mostly formal.
It was black tie, wasn't it?
I think that you would consider this to be like weekend resort wear.
That's true. Fucking no, Richard was wearing this kind of weird baby blue, like double breasted.
He was wearing the Jim Carrey or the Jeff Daniels tux from fucking
the powder
Dumb
blue
and Dumber
tuxedo.
So it's not formal wear. It's like relaxed, like out on the cape.
I get what
wear,
you're saying.
You know,
like,
what I'm saying?
Fucking Hampton.
So
type
it's
shit.
Like, would you tell your guest who clearly doesn't have that
in his duffel bag?
Yeah, he doesn't have that wardrobe. Would you give him the choice? Hey, here's the style event. We can go get you some stuff. Are you comfortable wearing your own stuff? Because I'm comfortable wearing your own stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Dundee probably would have been comfortable. Like, I'll just wear what I got. Like,
I think
it would have been an interesting thing, especially, you know, as the scene plays out, if he's like, I'm trying to be who she wants me to be. And she, you know, likes the other guy. Like,
I
I'm
feel
just
like
going to be
not his style,
but no, I don't think he compromises himself.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. So, Dad Charlton, he's ascotted, comes over, greets the group and thanks Mick for saving his daughter's life. Mick says, buy me a cold beer and we'll call it quits.
I love that.
I do too. And Dad Charlton seems equally up to, like, he's like, yeah, that's badass.
Yeah.
So he takes him to meet some people.
Sets him up with a martini. Dundee's been on a steady diet of martinis since he got to New York.
Which I feel like for someone like him, it's just like vodka and a little vermouth. It's like, that's nothing.
Sure. An olive that he always discards, which is probably like more my style. Like, I don't eat the olive.
I love the olive. So he's like, so people are like, how are you finding New York? He's like, bit of a lunatic asylum, eh? That's why I love it. Because I fit right in. Badass.
It should be an obvious sign to Sue that everybody loves Dundee. Like, everyone loves this guy except for Richard. It's like either there's something wrong with Richard because he doesn't like him, or not everybody likes Richard and everyone likes Dundee. Like, he's a good guy and he's a dirtbag.
Yeah. So Sue comes over, interrupts, and says she wants to introduce Mick to the senator, that's Senator Manley. Mm-hmm. She reveals that the woman who Mick just met, Dorothy, sees a psychiatrist. And then,
it's a weird thing to mention.
But I guess and this is something that I grabbed just from watching the closed captioning, is that Dorothy is Sue's dad's wife or girlfriend moment.
I didn't catch that.
He introduces her as, this is my Dorothy.
Ah.
And so that's like his
second wife, or
his boo thing. And then Mick kicks himself for the lunatic crack that he made because he didn't know Dorothy.
I didn't realize she was crazy.
I didn't know she was nuts. And then Sue says she's seeing a therapist is no big deal. It helps to get things out in the open. But it just kind of put it in perspective who like Dorothy was, or like dad's like second wife or whatever, or girlfriend or something.
I certainly didn't pick up on that.
So I love that Sue says like talking to a therapist helps to get things out in the open. Then Mick's like, doesn't she have friends? Doesn't she have mates? Mm-hmm. And that's some wisdoms. Talk to your friends, folks.
Well, it's talking to somebody.
Yeah, talk to someone. Yeah.
Right. I feel like this must have been the early days of
like mental health therapy awareness
being like mainstream, like a movement. People seeing a therapist just for maintenance, you know.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Not because you had some type of a major problem or some shit.
And Mick says, you know, in Australia, you just tell Walt, and then he tells everyone else, and then you don't have a problem anymore. which is also, you know, it's kind of awesome.
That's great.
But yes, across the room, we see Richard mingling, being a total douche. Like, is this your sister?
Tired jokes.
Richard sucks. Later on after dinner, which we surmise is after dinner because everyone's like getting their brandy in a snifter.
I thought there was pie on plates. Yeah.
Pie on plates, brandy and snifters. Richard clangs loudly on a glass and gets up and makes a toast to Sue's return. He offers a gracious thanks to Mick for saving Sue and for increased circulation of the paper.
I don't know if this was a performance choice by the actor or what, but it felt to me like Richard is sort of putting on an act, not speaking from the cuff, not speaking off the cuff. Like, it felt like very rehearsed.
No,
I don't know if that's because
he'd been thinking about this. I think he'd probably been thinking about it since before Sue and Mick came back,
and exactly how I'm going to present myself and what I'm going to say.
I think that when he felt threatened, he was like, must speed up operations.
Yeah. I also thought it was just odd that they sat Mick far away from Sue, like among strangers. But we know he's like an extroverted, dude. He'll make friends.
Probably Richard was like,
Richard was behind that shit?
Definitely. He contacted Dad Charlton and was like, put him down the table.
They had like that cartoon type, the long table.
Yeah.
That you see. Like, time. I don't know that I've ever seen
like
that.
Downton Abbey.
It's like some Batman Bruce Wayne type shit. The extra long table with 40 people at a 20 person long table.
Definitely.
Nuts. It's like comic book shit.
So yeah, he slips the ring. He being Richard slips the ring on Sue's finger without her giving an answer. Mick, we get a cut over to Mick, who looks sort of like very disappointed.
It's weird. She looked delighted at first, but then
she's like smiling.
Once the ring went on the finger, then I felt like she
looks uncertain. Like she doesn't know how to look. But then Richard kisses Sue. Everyone claps. Mick tries to play it cool. As Richard's yucking it up with Senator Manley and Papa Charlton, Sue and Mick are taking turns staring at each other, but both are failing to make eye contact.
Dude, that was like, talk about getting your heart stomped on, for one.
Ugh.
But also, that moment was like heartbreaking and incredible to me. Like, movies in general, movies are amazing.
Aren't they? 100%.
Like, how they can tell a story and use music and shit to make you feel like passionate about the fact that, no, these two people should be together. Like, what the fuck is like
three quick cuts or two quick cuts between minutes. Two people just looking at each other and you know what they're feeling.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That scene was just like,
I'm with you.
My heart broke for both of them.
100%. I'm with you. So Mick rightfully ducks out early from the party and tells Gus that this time he's going to ride in the back of the limo to be alone with his feelings. Yeah. One thinks, he conspicuously removes his knife from his waistband.
We told him, like, you know, going to go back to the hotel, Mick?
Yeah.
But yeah, by way of a liquor store.
Yeah, he's like, swing me by a liquor store on the way back.
Hell yes.
Hey, yeah,
that's exactly what's up, man. Yeah. That moment, like, just drink your feelings.
But then who but Reginald Bell Johnson / Gus would say, hey, man, I got a bottle of scotch up here for you for medicinal purposes. Oh. It's a national treasure, he is.
Dude, he's got a knack, Vel Johnson, of instantly being someone that you want to be friends with.
I hope that we get to meet him in life at some point.
I think it's like the smile in his voice. His voice is so warm.
Yeah, he's amazing. So after we assume they've been driving around while Mick's been drinking.
Well, he's driving him back from Yonkers or wherever there's meant long to time. Be it's all like the 40, way back to 45 Midtown.
Minute, yeah. A 45, 50 minute drive probably. Gus drops a wobbly Dundee right off in the heart of Times Square of all the places.
I like the touch that Gus seemed hesitant.
Yeah, he's like, you be sure careful. You're all right, yeah, he's buddy. Like, but and then also after Mick gets out of the limo, like Gus is watching him.
There's
like
a long shot of him like, I don't know about Mick, because this is the one moment in the movie that we've seen Mick seem intoxicated.
Yeah, he's vulnerable, like physically vulnerable.
And so yeah.
So while Mick is walking around, he gives the last of the bottle to a homeless guy, which is stand up, but also bad for the homeless guy's addiction. So then he spots who he thinks is Simone, the hooker from earlier in the movie, but it turns out to be a different hooker.
Like the earlier hookers, though, these two were also just incredibly gorgeous.
Yeah, they're fit.
Well, I don't know how he's managed to find an empty alley like right off of Times Square.
Yeah, that doesn't exist, and I don't think I don't have any experience.
I don't know that there's New York's done some shit. I don't know that those alleys exist anymore.
You've cleaned Midtown. That Midtown does not exist in this dojo, does it? It does not. It doesn't. Like that 1980s Midtown, I don't think exists anymore. I think that if there are hookers, they're operating on a much higher level. Like
it's all probably internet based.
Well, it's internet based, and it's like you have to go to this bar and enter a code, and that person's there, or something happens.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just saying, like,
you know a lot.
I'm
kidding.
I actually don't. I don't. So at that point, a man turns the corner, and it seems that the different hookers, unfortunately, have the same pimp that the earlier hookers had.
This is a weird moment to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know anything about pimping.
Same.
I know it. I know it ain't easy. But I would think pimps have like an area, like a turf, and this area
turf
is far from the East Village. Like this dude's running shit here too. He's all over the city.
It's dozens and dozens of blocks north.
Oh yeah, it's a long way
east.
It's a long way from East Village, but. Yeah. Maybe this guy's got it like that because his stable of women is impeccable.
Wait, where's the? I can't think of where Midtown is. Yeah, so it's Midtown is north of East Village.
Yeah, much. So, yeah. It's 20, 30 blocks away.
So this guy is the guy that Dundee laid out earlier. He signals, the girls scram, and two goons jump out of a giant Oldsmobile, and he says, Well, if ain't the man that don't like bad fucking language in front of ladies. It's like, what's the matter, Aussie boy? You gonna hop away like a kangaroo?
That is weird. They saved up their one F-bomb for that moment.
Yeah.
As opposed to earlier.
Yeah.
But I think the Academy,
right?
Well, no, is that what it is? The MPAA. They might say like using fucking as a adjective versus referring to it as a verb is different.
It is. And that it totally is.
That gets a PG-13, but that gets an
you're
R.
You're going to talk to him or fuck him.
You're going to talk to him or make it with one right. of them.
Can't say that. So Mick, once again, decks the fuck out of this guy. The goons.
That was amazing.
Yeah, and just like lays him out again.
Dundee is quick to punch somebody. Yeah, well, I love it.
You don't talk dirty in front of ladies. So the goons square up on him. He reaches for his knife, but as we know, he left it in the limo.
Fuck.
Then he tries to pull the mesmerized move on one guy. Doesn't work. He sucker punches that guy. Then the guys tackle Dundee to the ground and appear about to rough him up good. And even the pimp is like rushing in to like, he's like, I'm going to tap dance on him. When Gus comes out of nowhere in the car and hits the pimp. And a goon with the limo, like cracking, like breaking the windshield all the hell.
I thought the goons were dressed really preppy. They were like wearing ties and like looked like they were on their way to like a swing dance.
They all
club.
Looked very, very like jump, jive, and wail sort of.
Yeah,
deal
like
going
some big bad voodoo daddy shit.
That's exactly what it was
something
like.
Something out of Swingers.
There were definitely like a black and white wingtips and some chain wallets, which is fine. Just don't
it's
hit
not
women
pimp.
Or
is that
hit
pimp
other
attire?
People.
Pimp henchman attire?
Pinchman. So I don't know what happens. Gus hits two guys with a car, which we hope they don't die.
That's, then yeah, Gus is committing crimes.
A third guy makes a run for it. Gus jumps out, snaps off the boomerang-shaped antenna from the back of the car and slings it as if he had experience in this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And takes the guy out from long range.
You know, this movie had to have like at least one boomerang gag.
I was shocked that it didn't happen earlier and that it wasn't repeated, but then it happened. So,
but since this moment, I've never been able to see an antenna like that on a car and not think about it, throwing it like wanting to break it off and throw it like a boomerang.
Same, brother. Same. Not one time. And so Gus helps Mick up and he's like, are you okay? Mick's like surveying Gus's handiwork with the antenna with great interest, sort of like he can't believe what happens. And he turns to him, he's like, you sure not with the Pitjantjatjara tribe? No, man, Harlem. And it's like a discrepancy, warlords or warthogs. I can't tell.
Yeah, neither one is. I grew up
is
always
it
thinking it was
gang.
I was assuming that was like a high school mascot or something.
Maybe.
But it's none of the above.
Right.
By my Google research.
Yeah. So and then. Mick's like, I knew you were tribal.
Man, I feel Gus is going to have some questions to answer when he brings back the fucked up limousine.
Well,
with the, like, the broken out windshield and shit.
Well, and I wonder if he probably knows the guy in the dead middle of the night to call
to
and
change
like,
a windshield.
We can forgo a conversation of any kind because the next morning out in Yonkers, he is.
Putting
that new antenna on the
and
car.
The windshield's been changed out, apparently.
Yeah. No calls needed to be made.
It's all off the books?
Yeah, that's what I think. Meanwhile, Sue, dressed as Greta Garbo, is placing a call to Mick's room at the plaza. At the plaza, the TV's cranked loud while Mick's brushing his teeth so it doesn't hear the phone ring.
The movie that was playing was Major Dundee.
That's awesome.
Yeah, a little whatever.
Yeah, a reference.
What,
of wait, some
what
kind.
Was she calling for? What was she going to say
I
if
think,
he answered?
I think, based on what we learn later, I think she was calling to
we
ask
need
him
to talk.
I think she was asking him to stay at the hotel. Hey, what are you doing this morning? Stay at the hotel. I'm going to be right there.
Like we should have a conversation.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I'm on the same page with you.
She's like, I'm going to show up in some major old Hollywood silent era.
You're going to cream your
and you are going to
cream
your
crocodile skin pants.
Yes. So hold on. Just wait on me. Unfortunately, he doesn't hear it. The woman in reception comes on the line and says, Mick's not answering. Oh, and also, he's going to be checking out today. We're sure going to miss him.
A lot of weird shit for for her to be. You shouldn't tell any rando caller, although they are paying the bill.
Hey, Esmeralda. Okay. So Sue ends up looking very bewildered, disappointed, like, what am I going to do now? So Mick, we see Mick walking out of the plaza with his bag slung over his shoulder. The doorman, Irving, with whom Mick's now got a rapport going, asks if he's heading home. Dundee says, I'm going to go and walk about. Want to see the country. For how long? Long as it takes. That's the dream, Kevin.
That would have been a nice sequel, too.
Cut?
I don't know if it ends right then, but, like, you know, if it ended differently, you could just say, let's see Dundee see the rest of the country.
I love it.
There's a lot to see here.
That would have been awesome.
Outside of New York.
I would have watched it. I watched it anyway, but I feel like that would have been a compelling ending as well.
Or if he just walked away from Sue. She might be bad news.
Yeah. At this point, we don't know what decisions have been made. So Mick asks Irving how to get out of the city fast. He wants to know, I need to get out fast. And he says, you know, two blocks down is the subway. You can get to Grand Central Station. So Mick walks off towards the subway. Moments later, the limo pulls up. Sue hops out, holding Dundee's knife.
That's odd.
Dad Charlton is in the limo with her and asks her, are you sure you know what you're doing? She says, no, but it'll come to me, which seems pretty cavalier.
I feel like she must have had a heart-to-heart with her dad in the car about,
I think I can't be with Richard. I think it was the night before when Mick left, she had a heart-to-heart with dad, and then she had to have told Richard. She has to have told Richard
already?
At this point.
Or she's a sack. I can't marry you.
Or she's a sack of shit. If she hasn't told Richard by this morning,
let me see if Dundee will
take me first.
Take me, and then
and then like maybe he won't, and then we're fine. That's bullshit. No, I think that she woke up first thing, went over to her dad's room in the weekend house, said
the East Wing.
I'm not feeling great about Richard. Here's what I'm thinking, and that he was like, well, go tell Richard, and then we'll run to the airport or run to the plaza or wherever.
In my recollection, when we saw her trying to call the hotel, she'd already broken it off with Richard.
Correct.
We hope.
That is my assumption.
If she's a decent human.
She had
to
have.
Once the crowd left from dinner, she said, look, Richard.
She pulled him aside.
I care for you,
maybe,
but.
Maybe even that night, she pulled him aside over brandies and cigars and was like, you suck. I can't do this.
I bet she was had a little bit more.
Tact.
Yeah, that's a great
word. Like, look, Richard,
I care for you greatly, but
things are great professionally.
Sure.
But you're not doing it for me in the down under region. So anyway.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, the doorman's like, run that way and you'll catch him.
You better hurry.
But she hands the knife to Irving and takes off speed walking towards the subway before she breaks into a full run. And at this point, it's like she's sitting there mouthing things. And it's like she all of a sudden remembered what walkabout meant and was like, oh, fuck.
Like he's gone.
She's like,
gone.
Yeah, like he's going to disappear.
18 months.
Yeah, she's like, he's going to disappear for more than a year if I don't catch him. So then we see Irving like inspecting the knife to the horror of the guests, which is kind of
nice
an awesome.
Laugh, yeah,
it's a good gag. We cut to a shot of Mick entering the subway station. Then a cut back to Sue as she's like kicking off her heels and then like actually sprinting down the street.
That's an image that's always stuck in my head of seeing the woman like barefoot running on the sidewalk full speed.
Yeah. At the station, Mick's working his way down to the end of the platform. Sue reaches the subway station where she's grabbed by some creep.
What the fuck was that moment? That was so weird.
It's like, why are we wasting time with this?
Well, I'm just like, what is that dude doing there?
Is he a perv?
Is he just waiting to be a creep if the opportunity presents itself?
I was like, this movie wastes no opportunity to depict New York as a wild and woolly place where people will grab you in any moment. And I guess that's not too far off in some respects, but it's like, it paints a pretty dark, bleak picture of New York.
It was odd as fuck. Yeah, the guy's like, hey lady, where you going? You want to play with someone?
It was super
aggressive.
Super aggressive.
She like the bystanders are just standing watching, like,
to grab people and molest
reaction
them?
Well, no, I'm saying, like, there were bystanders standing there just watching this happen.
Yeah, oh, that's a good point.
And they
too.
Weren't doing anything.
It's like someone would grab your grabbed him and been like, get off him.
Hey, what, bro, what the fuck are you doing, man? It was odd, dude. She like kneed him in the junk, and I swear these dudes who were working the newsstand were like just
okay
watching completely reactionless.
But that's the thing, is like, I think that is New York. It's like they see that shit sort of happen and they're like,
it might be like, oh yeah, this guy, he hangs out, he does that every day.
Yeah. Also, I checked the geography of all this, checks out.
Okay. Is there a station?
You can see behind her as she starts to go down into the subway. Like, I recognize the monument that is Columbus Circle.
Okay. And which is near the plaza.
That's about two blocks from the Plaza Hotel along Central Park. So
they filmed it like somewhere in Brooklyn in an abandoned.
Well, that was all around Central Park.
But the interior.
Yeah.
Like on the platform is somewhere in Brooklyn.
Right.
Yeah.
So in the station, she spots Mick way the hell down at the end of the platform. She's like screaming for him, but he can't hear.
There were more people on that platform than could fit on a train.
That was the only time I've seen that many people on a subway platform, was in China. And it was like the subway system in China was a whole other planet from what it is in New York. People think people in New York are rude. Ain't never been to China. People in China will fucking, it's like, mow you down. It's like, so anyway, she yells his name, she gets nothing. She gives that hoot from Walt back at the at the lake, still nothing. So finally she's screaming, she gets the attention of a Caribbean man. I looked him up.
He's from Trinidad and Tobago.
Yeah,
the actor,
from Trinidad. Yeah. Like, he had some credits in the 80s and 90s. I think he's apparently passed away at this point.
Bummer.
He gets the attention of a construction worker further down the platform, who then gets Dundee's attention. So they tell him that the lady at the end of the platform has a message for him. And it is, I think, yeah, I agree with your assessment. It's one of the most romantic games of telephone ever. Like, this scene, this scene is amazing. Roger Ebert says that this scene would have been in like the most iconic scenes of all time had the chemistry between Paul Hogan and Linda been better.
Bullshit. Yeah. Roger.
Yeah. He says it would have been better, because he says it's perfect, but as it is, it's you remember it more because of the charisma of the other actors in the scene.
I want to know who came up with this unorthodox idea, like, of how to end this thing.
I hope it was Paul Hogan.
It was so clever and unique.
Oh, awesome.
That's what I'm saying. It had to be one of those three people who came, but it's like, so, like, what can we do? This,
like, hey, fella, this the lady at the platform wants to talk to you.
What if
does she want?
What if they're relaying it?
What does she want? What do you want?
When he said, he was kind of aggressive, wasn't he?
No, what do you want?
What do you want?
And she says, tell him not to leave. I'm not going to marry Richard. I guess Richard knows this. And this is where I said, Richard must know this by
now. She's already had that conversation. Yeah.
So
she
it's
says,
like,
don't leave. She's not going to marry Richard.
She's not going to marry Richard. Don't leave. I'm not going to marry Richard.
Why not?
I don't know. Why not?
Like, why not? Then the Caribbean dude had become, like, all of a sudden very tender.
Very, like, sentimental.
Well, why not?
Yeah. Tell him I love him. I love you. He's I love you.
And the guy's like, I love you. I love you.
Yeah.
And Dundee's like looking around.
Yeah,
he's
looking
like,
around
she loves
at people. It's like, she loves me. He's like very delighted about this. So the onlookers on the platform are amused. Dundee tries to make his way to her, but the platform's too crowded.
So we're jammed in here like sheep.
Yeah. So he's like, Australian. So he tells the people around him, up, up, up. They lift him. And then he wades across the waters like Jesus, standing on their heads and shoulders all the way to Sue. The people of New York are loving being walked on.
That moment with the music swelling and everything. Yeah. So another one of those just like perfect movie
moments.
It's
also awesome. Like, during this whole sequence, you can hear the didgeridoo in the background of the sound, like of the soundtrack. It's pretty awesome. So once Mick finally makes it over to Sue, they exchange an epic embrace to the applause of countless thousands of New Yorkers. Freeze frame. Roll credits. Number two box office movie of 1986.
They were quick on that freeze and fade out, just like Raw Deal.
They're like, we ain't got nothing else.
That must have been an editing technique that was in vogue at that moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you said, number two movie of 1986, right behind Top Gun.
$129.5 million,
and
Kevin.
$350 worldwide. Fuck. Amazing on like a $10 million budget.
For less, like, yeah.
Less money than Raw deal cost.
That's absolute insanity.
So we went over the 86 box office at the end of our last series on Raw deal.
Right.
So if you want to hear about 86, we suggest you go check that out.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, Paul Hogan, he parlayed this into co-hosting the 87 Oscars.
That's astounding.
Amazing to me. On talk the wave about, of the like, success.
Talk about charisma, folks. Think about the actor or public personality that you could think like comes out of nowhere to do something. And then
it has happened. Yeah. Like you seen like where a Russell Brand type has a moment. They come from nowhere and they're big and then they're gone.
Right.
Just as quick.
And now he's sort of. He's like the anti-Joe Rogan conspiracy theorist or something.
Who, Russell Brand is? Yeah, I haven't been keeping up with his shit at all.
He's on YouTube, and it's like it's sort of a leftist-leaning podcast, but it's like he's still like, question the science. And I'm like,
fuck off, bro.
Yeah, man. We don't need your voice in the conversation. You're not a scientist.
But yeah, the movie was nominated for Best Original Screenplay at those same Oscars.
And
did not take it home.
Paul Hogan won a Golden Globe for Best Actor.
Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy.
And I didn't realize that, but I also, he was nominated, or he won a BAFTA, nominated for a BAFTA.
I don't know that one. I don't think he won it. Yeah.
Yeah. Think nominated.
They probably don't sort theirs by genre.
No, I think it's just like you won it or you didn't win it.
He also fell in love with Linda Kozlowski, I guess, on the set during the production. She went on to become his second wife.
Right.
His third marriage, though. He married... The first woman
young.
Divorced her and married her again a year later. That's kind of crazy.
I feel like there's a Paul Hogan thing to do.
It kind of is, right? Yeah, he remarried that woman about a year after their divorce.
It's not working. Let's get married.
But that second time he got divorced was apparently like very ugly and tabloid fodder. He'd been cheating. He had met this woman on the set of his movie. It was like that Meg Ryan situation. And it came right at the height of his fame, like 86.
What was the Meg Ryan thing?
She was married to Dennis Quaid.
Remember that?
And fucked around with Russell Crowe, like
that's
when they met
it.
On
yep.
Proof of Life.
Yep.
Which was ironically a movie about how her character's husband had been kidnapped and Russell Crowe comes around and she's sort of smitten by him, but realizes I have to be faithful to my husband.
Yeah.
I can't just fucking run off with this dashing Australian.
Right.
Oh shit. He's Australian.
Oh, shit. Fuck.
They should sue Crocodile Dundee.
Is Proof of Life Crocodile Dundee?
It's a retelling.
It's more action though.
Yeah. Right.
That's amazing. Oh shit, maybe we should do a series about that.
I love that movie to be honest, man. But yeah, he married Kozlowski in 1990, as you mentioned previously. I think they divorced 2014.
Yeah, sad times.
He remains a megastar in Australia, like beloved. All the things he does are a big deal in Australia. He's like their, I don't know, who's the most iconic living actor,
an elder statesman,
yeah, like a Pacino or a De Niro or somebody.
I think De Niro probably is our elder statesman.
He's probably
right?
Like that type of dude. That's
crazy.
Or a Nicholson or somebody. Like,
When was the last time you saw Nicholson?
Has he retired from acting? He doesn't really work anymore.
Nuh-uh. He must be getting to that point to where he's just like,
well, it's like Connery when Connery went away and he's like, I just don't feel it. And Hackman.
I saw awesome interviews recently with Robert Duvall and with
Eastwood,
Sonny Corleone,
James
Caan. Yeah.
I feel like Eastwood's gonna kick the bucket soon.
Yeah, I think he is probably too.
I saw this trailer for that Cry Macho shit, and I'm just like, feel like he's so feeble.
Is this your? This is like his like
gonna be your last
song?
Film.
He's fucking 90 something years old now.
Yeah, dude, he's up there, mid 90s,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I feel like Clint Eastwood's been playing the same crotchety old fuck for years, which is great because it's awesome.
He's
but
good
it's still
at
like,
it.
It's like this is El Camino, but with a different Mexican secondary lead.
Shit. True. Also
it's,
true.
It's the truth.
He's not Hmong. He's Mexican this time around, or the mule. or a fucking $1 million baby. Yeah, he's been doing that. It's been done, Clint. But, you know.
I hope he's finding himself, though.
Fuck. I'm going to watch the shit out of it when it comes out. I'm curious.
I would love to watch it with you because I would love to sit down and have some objective.
Did you watch The Mule?
No, I never saw
Excellent.
It.
Excellent.
Is it?
Yeah, it's really
It looked
good.
Really good. It looked awesome.
This move back to Crocodile Dundee.
All right. Fine.
Okay.
Hit it.
The fucking quotation marks in the credits, quotation marks around Crocodile. Strange. Apparently that was like a weird touch that was the American distributors insisted. We got to put quotation marks around Crocodile so that the audience doesn't think it's actually going to be about a crocodile. What the fuck is going on in these meetings, high level meetings at studios?
Well, what if someone tries to animate it?
Fuck, I don't know, man. That reminds me.
Okay, well, get out in front of that and say, don't animate it.
I'm going to tell you a story that I hope makes you laugh.
It will. It will, for sure will.
So, on Back to the Future, originally, the first draft, Doc Brown's pet, Einstein, was going to be a chimp.
Okay.
That was, and they, you know, they turned the scripts into whoever it was, Universal, I think. Mm-hmm. Head of Universal is like, you got to get rid of the chimp. He's like, I've done the research. No movie with a chimp has ever made money. Like, what the fuck?
How?
And then they were like, well, what about those Clint Eastwood movies? The Any Which Way But Loose? He's like, no, that's an orangutan. It was like, you fucking assholes. What's happening in these boardrooms that you're doing research on? Give me every movie that's ever had a chimp in it. First of all, Tarzan movies slayed.
But that's the thing is that these guys in movies, they look over at their secretary and they go, I need all the numbers on movies with chimps.
Any movie that's ever had a chimp in the past 50 years, and bring me the box office.
It's there in an hour. Oh my God, that's amazing.
Now, yeah, I will say, if Back to the Future had a chimp instead of a dog, that would have been fucking weird.
Yeah.
That's a good note from the studio. Because him having a pet chimp would just be some not Michael cool. Jackson type bubbles shit.
Would have been not cool. And people would not like, because no American has a pet chimp. Everyone can identify with a dog.
Sure.
That's my dog that's going back in
Don't
time.
Don't you get it? He's eccentric. He's got a chimp. No, that'd be fucking odd.
Plus the dog was white and looked like an Einstein. Whitish. It had like wild hair.
He was dirty. He was dishwater blonde.
Dishwater blonde dog.
I feel like this movie owes a huge debt to Romancing the Stone.
Big time.
It's like they sort of made a killing off that sort of romantic adventure story, which I don't feel like this movie happens if Romancing the Stone hadn't been a hit.
Romancing the Stone is an objectively better movie than this one.
They're both, like, if you watch them, they're both one of those that you can watch and say, like, this movie is practically perfect.
Yeah.
Like, there's not anything you should really change. There's not a lot that you could do to improve this. But, yeah, Romancing the Stone is strong.
The through line of Romancing the Stone is much stronger. Because there's a reason for them to be on that quest. Whereas...
There is no quest on this.
Is the quest.
Yeah.
Finding the story of Mick Dundee and then transmitting it to the world is the quest.
Like, it's the love story and not much else.
He's the stone.
Sure.
Mick Dundee is the stone.
He is the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
This film, I guess.
He's the Jewel of the Nile.
The Jewel of the Nile. Both movies with kind of shit sequels, but I love them still.
I'm going to watch them tonight.
A double feature starting at 1 a.m.
I have to be up in 6 hours.
Fuck us. The reviews to this movie were overall positive, but there were some high profile critics that hated it. Ebert among them.
He thought it was shocked.
Middle of the road.
Middle of the road, which I was sort of surprised by.
He was serving like some stay off my lawn vibes, like saying they made this kind of movie better in the 30s. Like, okay.
It was very strange, and I felt like it was incomplete criticism. It was like, I saw it and I was like, well, meh.
I don't know what movie he was watching though that he did not sense chemistry between Sue and Mick.
Same.
I wonder if they were doing the casting process and Dundee, or I should say Paul Hogan, was like, wow, me and this lady have chemistry. That's what we should base this casting on. And it, you know, was the the downfall of his marriage and everything. Like that, you know, you sort of 30-ish years, he and his wife,
years or whatever. Yeah,
yeah, as long as Linda had been alive, long enough to have a son that was older than Linda, I think.
Yikes.
It's odd. But the last thing to mention, I guess, is as it was mentioned early on, I think, by Mike, there was a real life dude named Rod Ansel who claimed that, you know, I'm the inspiration for this character.
Is he Frank Dukes?
Oh, shit. He was a Bushman.
Okay.
He was he got stranded in the outback for like 2 months in 1977 after like his fishing boat sank. He wasn't attacked by a croc or anything like that. But he got 15 minutes of fame out of it when he stumbled back into civilization. The only thing I'll say is there was a thing where he said, you know, they put me in a nice hotel, but I could only sleep on the floor, which I could say you stole that maybe. You know, Paul Hogan, he maintains that the character is an original creation, which I mean, you know, what's original anymore?
Right.
Like, what story can you tell that bear a similarity to something?
That same guy could watch Homeland and be like, well, that after that guy came home from being tortured, he slept on the floor. And that was my story.
So did Julius Benedict in Twins. Yeah, exactly. He couldn't sleep in a mattress.
I sleep on the floor.
I only sleep on the floor. Money.
Well, that's my story. Money.
God damn, she's hot.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Kelly Preston. You should have been in this movie. She would have been a great...
She would have been way too young.
Yeah, she would have been a great Sue.
She would have been like 20.
Ooh, or younger.
Maybe.
She'd have been like 17 or something
she's
weird.
She's only 17. Woo! Anyway,
that, friends,
the Fosters is talking now.
Ow! That's Crocodile Dundee. Did you love it? We know you did.
I love the movie.
This was an awesome blast from the past. It was near and dear to my heart.
It's an iconic movie for a reason, because it, for the most part, 98% it holds up.
Yep.
It's like a Back to the Future. It's like a Top Gun. I defy you not to like this movie. Like, it's just, there's nothing not to like about it. This movie, crowd pleaser, tells a great story.
Yeah.
Somehow it tells a great story in like 95 minutes.
Yep. Super economical.
How much shit happens in a movie that short? I love it. They kept it moving, but it doesn't feel rushed.
No.
It's perfectly paced.
Lovable. Yeah. It's charming.
Fucking brilliant film.
For the most part. For the most part, it's charming.
Yeah. And it's just an iconic movie of the 80s, of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we hope you guys have enjoyed this recap. We hope that you've enjoyed listening and following along. We hope you'll go back and revisit this as well.
Watch it.
Yeah. Go watch it and enjoy it.
Enjoy a Foster's while you do it.
And definitely, or two.
Throw
or
another
three.
Shrimp on the Barbie or whatever the fuck else you do.
And then tune in next time. Thanks again to Mike for coming and hanging out with us.
Mike, we love you.
And thanks for the last of the Action Heroes Podcast Network for hanging out with us.
Yeah. It's sleepy time now.
Yeah, we're super tired. It's time to go to bed.
But we love you, and we will be back.
We'll be back.